podcast for my mother. She read to me when I was little, so now I'm returning the favour and you're welcome to listen along. It's Thursday, and that means I'm reading something offbeat. Sundays are for classics. But whatever I'm reading, it's always great writing. Tonight, I'm reading some writing that is so bad it is considered a classic. These opening words in this order are applauded as terrible and have been since they were written almost 200 years ago in 1830. It was a dark and stormy night. What's so bad about that? And who is responsible? What's so bad about it is all the words that follow the truly awful 1830 book titled Paul Clifford by Edward Bulwer Lytton, an Englishman who lived from 1803 to 1873, a well-to-do gent, a baron, in fact, who was a politician and profligate writer, as well as a pants man, and bottom line, he was a massive meanie. He married, cheated almost immediately, and his Irish bride was having none of it. An acrimonious divorce followed, resulting in his hurt ex-wife denouncing him for his infidelities in public while he was campaigning for political office. So he cut her off from their two kids. Then he found two, quote, medical men. One was an ophthalmologist and the other one an apothecary, that's an eye doctor and a chemist, who had her sectioned, committed to an asylum. She was very quickly released because she wasn't mad. She was angry. Two very different states of being. And the public all knew that he had acted quite wrongly in doing that to her. Edward George Earl Lytton Bulwer Lytton, 1st Baron Lytton, I'll just call him Lytton for this podcast, wrote so much and enjoyed a successful career as an author and politico, and none of it stands up. In amongst the drivel and weirdo occult ideas, he wrote something so bad it's still celebrated today as the epitome of bad writing. The novel Paul Clifford, which begins, "It was a dark and stormy night," but wait till you hear the rest. Now, I have had a dark and stormy cocktail, just a small one, before starting this recording, in a very dark and stormy Sydney, by the way. La Nina is still with us. I felt the need of some booze, because this writing is truly, classically dreadful. I'm not even sure how much I can stand to read of this. I'm going to try to read Chapter 1 of Edward Bulwer Lytton's 1830 novel. I'm lonely laughing because it's the rictus grin of a monkey terrified about something. Edward Bulwer Lytton's 1830 novel, Paul Clifford. Let's begin. It was a dark and stormy night. The rain fell in torrents, except at occasional intervals, when it was checked by a violent gust of wind which swept up the trees, for it is in London that our scene lies, rattling along the housetops and fiercely agitating the scanty flame of the lamps that struggled against the darkness. Through one of the obscurest quarters of London, and among haunts little loved by the gentlemen of the police, a man, evidently of the lowest orders, was wending his solitary way. He stopped twice or thrice at different shops and houses of a description correspondent with the appearance of the quartier in which they were situated, and tendered inquiry for some article or another which did not seem easily to be met with. All the answers he received were couched in the negative, and as he turned from each door, he muttered to himself, in no very elegant phraseology, his disappointment and discontent. At length, at one house, the landlord, a sturdy butcher, after rendering the same reply the inquirer had hitherto received, added But if this will do as well, dummy, it is quite at your service. Pausing reflectively for a moment, Dummy responded that he thought the thing proffered might do as well, and thrusting it into his ample pocket, he strode away with as rapid a motion as the wind and the rain would allow. He soon came to a nest of low and dingy buildings, at the entrance to which, in half-effaced characters, was written, Thames Court. Halting at the most conspicuous of these buildings, an inn or alehouse, through the half-closed windows of which blazed out in ruddy comfort the beams of the hospitable hearth, he knocked hastily at the door. He was admitted by a lady of a certain age, and endowed with a comely rotundity of face and person. "Hast got it, dummy?" she asked quickly as she closed the door on the guest.
No, not exactly, but I thinks as how..."
"Oh, pish, you fool," cried the woman, interrupting him peevishly. "Why, it's no use deceiving me. You knows you's only stepped from my boozing ken to another, and you has not been art of the book at all. So there's the poor creature, a raven and a dying, and you..."
"Let I speak," interrupted Dummy in his turn. "I tells you, I went first to Mother Brossbones, who I knows chops them whiners morning and evening to the young ladies, and I axes there for a Bible, and she says only a companion to the halter. But you'll get a Bible, I think, at Master Talkin's, the cobbler as preaches. So I goes to Master Talkin's, and he says he, I has no call for the Bible, but you might be getting it at the butcher's over the way. So I goes over the way, and the butcher says he, I has not a Bible, but I has a book of plays bound for all the world just like one, and mayhap the poor creature mayn't see the difference. So I takes the plays, Mrs. Margery, and here they be, surely. And how's poor Judy?"
"Fearsome. She'll not be over the night, I'm a-thinking.
Well, I'll track up the dancers."
So saying, Dummy ascended a doorless staircase, across the entrance of which a blanket, stretched angularly from the wall to the chimney, afforded a kind of screen. And presently he stood within a chamber which the dark and painful genius of Crabbe might have delighted to portray. The walls were whitewashed, and at sundry places strange figures and grotesque characters had been traced by some mirthful inmate, in which sable outline as the end of a smoked stick or the edge of a piece of charcoal is wont to produce. The wan and flickering light afforded by a farthing candle gave a sort of grimness and menace to these achievements of pictorial art, especially as they more than once received embellishments from portraits of Satan, such as he is accustomed to be drawn. A low fire burned gloomily in the sooty grate, and on the hob hissed the still small voice of an iron kettle. On a round deal table were two vials, a cracked cup, a broken spoon of some dull metal, and upon two or three mutilated chairs were scattered various articles of female attire. On another table, placed below a high, narrow, shutterless casement, athwart which, instead of a curtain, a checked apron had been loosely hung, and now waved fitfully to and fro in the gusts of wind that made easy ingress through many a chink and cranny, were a looking-glass, sundry appliances of the toilet, a box of coarse rouge, a few ornaments of more show than value, and a watch, the regular and calm click of which produced that indescribably painful feeling which we fear many of our readers who have heard the sound in a sick chamber can easily recall. A large tester bed stood opposite to this table, and the looking-glass partially reflected curtains of a faded stripe, and ever and anon, as the position of the sufferer followed the restless emotion of a disordered mind,
glimpses of the face of one on whom death was rapidly hastening. Beside this bed now stood Dummy, a small, thin man dressed in a tattered plush jerkin from which the raindrops slowly dripped, and with a thin, yellow, cunning physiognomy grotesquely hideous in feature, but not positively villainous in expression. On the other side of the bed stood a little boy of about 3 years old, dressed as if belonging to the better classes, although the garb was somewhat tattered and discoloured. The poor child trembled violently and evidently looked with a feeling of relief on the entrance of Dummy. And now there slowly, and with many a physical sigh, heaved towards the foot of the bed the heavy frame of the woman who had accosted Dummy below and had followed him, hord passibus aqueous, to the room of the sufferer. She stood with a bottle of medicine in her hand, shaking its contents up and down, and with a kindly yet timid compassion spread over a countenance crimsoned with habitual libations. This made the scene, save that on a chair by the bedside lay a profusion of long glossy golden ringlets which had been cut from the head of the sufferer when the fever had begun to mount upwards, but which, with a jealousy that portrayed the darling littleness of a vain heart, she had seized and insisted on retaining near her. And save that, by the fire, perfectly inattentive to the event about to take place within the chamber, and to which we of the biped race attach so awful an importance, lay a large grey cat, curled in a ball, and dozing with half-shut eyes, and ears that now and then denoted, by a gentle inflection, the jar of a louder or nearer sound than usual upon her lethargic senses. The dying woman did not at first attend to the entrance either of Dummy or the female at the foot of the bed, but she turned herself round towards the child, and grasping his arm fiercely, she drew him towards her and gazed on his terrified features with a look in which exhaustion and an exceeding wanness of complexion were even horribly contrasted by the glare and energy of delirium. "If you are like him," she muttered, "I will strangle you, I will." "I tremble. You ought to tremble when your mother touches you, or when he is mentioned. You have his eyes, you have. Out with them, out. The devil sits laughing in them. Oh, you weep, do you, little one? Well, now, be still, my love. Be hushed. I would not harm thee. Harm? Oh, God, he is my child after all." And at these words, she clasped the boy passionately to her breast and burst into tears. "Come now, come," said Dummy, soothingly. "Take the stuff, Judith, and then we'll talk over the urchin." The mother relaxed her grasp of the boy, and turning towards the speaker, gazed at him for some moments with a bewildered stare. At length, she appeared slowly to remember him, and said, as she raised herself on one hand and pointed the other towards him with an inquiring gesture, "Thou hast brought the book?" Dummy answered by lifting up the book he had brought from the honest butcher's. "Clear the room, then," said the sufferer, with that air of mock command so common to the insane. "We would be alone." Dummy winked at the good woman at the foot of the bed, and she, though generally no easy person to order or to persuade, left, without reluctance, the sick chamber. "If she be going to pray," murmured our landlady, for that office did the good matron hold, "I may indeed as well take myself off, for it's not very comfortable like for those who will be old to hear all that here." With this pious reflection, the hostess of the Mug, so was the hostelry called, heavily descended the creaking stairs. "Now, man," said the sufferer sternly, "swear that you will never reveal. Swear, I say, and by the great God whose angels are about this night, if ever you break the oath, I will come back and haunt you to your dying day." Dummy's face grew pale, for he was superstitiously affected by the vehemence and the language of the dying woman, and he answered, as he kissed the pretended Bible, that he swore to keep the secret as much as he knew of it, which, she must be sensible, he said, was very little. As he spoke, the wind swept with a loud and sudden gust down the chimney and shook the roof above them so violently as to loosen many of the crumbling tiles, which fell one after the other with a crashing noise on the pavement below. Dummy started in a fright, and perhaps his conscience smote him for the trick he had played with regard to the false Bible. But the woman, whose excited and unstrung nerves led her astray from one subject to another with preternatural celerity, said with an hysterical laugh, "See, dummy, they come in state for me. Give me the cap yonder and bring the looking-glass." Dummy obeyed, and the woman, as she in a low tone uttered something about the unbecoming colour of the ribbons, adjusted the cap on her head, and then, saying in a regretful and petulant voice, "Why should they have cut off my hair? Such a disfigurement!" bade Dummy desire Mrs. Margery once more to ascend to her. Left alone with her child, the face of the wretched mother softened as she regarded him, and all the levities and all the vehemences, if we may use the word, which in the turbulent commotion of her delirium had been stirred upward to the surface of her mind, gradually now sank as death increased upon her, and a mother's anxiety rose to the natural level from which it had been disturbed and abased. She took the child to her bosom, and clasping him in her arms, which grew weaker with every instant, she soothed him with the sort of chant which nurses sing over their untoward infants. But her voice was cracked and hollow, and as she felt it was so, the mother's eyes filled with tears. Mrs. Margery now re-entered, and turning towards the hostess with an impressive calmness of manner which astonished and awed the person she addressed, the dying woman pointed to the child and said, "You have been kind to me, very kind, and may God bless you for it. I have found that those whom the world calls the worst are often the most human. But I am not going to thank you as I ought to do, but to ask of you a last and exceeding favour. Protect my child till he grows up. You have often said you loved him. You are childless yourself, and a morsel of bread and a shelter for the night, which is all I ask of you to give him, will not impoverish more legitimate claimants." Poor Mrs. Margery, fairly sobbing, vowed she would be a mother to the child and that she would endeavour to rear him honestly, though a public house was not, she confessed, the best place for good examples. "Take him," cried the mother hoarsely, as her voice, failing her strength, rattled indistinctly and almost died within her. "Take him. Rear him as you will, as you can, any example, any roof better than—" Here the words were inaudible. "And oh, may it be a curse and a— give me the medicine, I am dying." The hostess, alarmed, hastened to comply, but before she returned to the bedside, the sufferer was insensible, nor did she again recover speech or motion. A low and rare moan only testified continued life, and within 2 hours that ceased, and the spirit was gone. At which time our good hostess was herself beyond the things of this outer world, having supported her spirits during the vigils of the night with so many little liquid stimulants that they finally sank into that torpor which generally succeeds excitement. Taking perhaps advantage of the opportunity which the insensibility of the hostess afforded him, Dummy, by the expiring ray of the candle that burned in the death chamber, hastily opened a huge box, which was generally concealed under the bed and contained the wardrobe of the deceased, and turned with irreverent hand over the linens and the silks, until quite at the bottom of the trunk he discovered some packets of letters. These he seized, and buried in the conveniences of his dress. He then, rising and replacing the box, cast a longing eye towards the watch on the toilet table, which was of gold. But he withdrew his gaze, and with a querulous sigh observed to himself,
"The old blowing kens of that, God ratter, but howsomever, I'll take this. Who knows, it may be of service. Tannies today may be smashed tomorrow."
Meaning, what is of no value may be precious hereafter. And he laid his coarse hand on the golden and silky tresses we have described.
"'Tis a rum business, and puzzles I, but mum's the word for my own little neck."
With this brief soliloquy, Dummy descended the stairs and let himself out of the house.
Goodness me, I've made it to the end. I've made it to the end of chapter one, and quite frankly, that's quite enough. I can't take much more of this. First of all, it's a ridiculous story. Why would you take the hair and not the watch? And second of all, it's exhausting.
Lytton's writing approach seemed to be use 10 words when one will do. Now, and I'm not saying that I would be any better. I couldn't do any better. But now that you've heard his work, I think you can understand the reason that the Edward Bulwer Lytton Fiction Award for Bad Writing exists even today. In Lytton's life, there were some great words. "The pen is mightier than the sword." That's his work. "The pursuit of the almighty dollar." That's him as well. But man, you have got to wade through all that guff that I just read in order to get to his few and far between gems. My favourite words related to Lytton are by a friend of his angry wife. Jane Carlyle was her name, and she wrote a letter to her husband in 1855, which is superb writing. Lytton's ex-wife made it her life's mission to make his life a misery and to point out to all and sundry what a shockingly bad husband he had been. She had taken to calling herself Lady Bulwer Lytton after he had been made a baron. He wasn't a lord and she wasn't a lady, but it was her way of continuing to trade on her defunct marriage to him. So in 1855, Lady Bulwer Lytton heard that Lytton was going to be in Hereford to do a political campaign speech, so she sprang into action. She decided to stand against him on the day as a wronged wife, and she had loads of placards made. She sped up to Hereford and arrived the night before Lytton's speech, in time to hire a pub worker to put her placards all over town before he arrived. She was intent on making a scene. And here is how Jane Carlyle wrote about that day. Let's begin. "Lady B, true to her oath that she would oppose Sir Liar the Coward at every step of his career, rendered herself to Hereford the evening before his election. For that night she kept herself incognita, but the town was astonished in the morning at seeing itself placarded all over with insults to Bulwer. In his absence, for he did not arrive till the business of the day commenced, his son, Robert Lytton, never dreaming who had done this thing, employed people to rush about and tear the placards down. Meanwhile, Lady B presented herself at the house of the mayor and demanded, as a British subject, to hire the town hall, therein to deliver a lecture on her husband. The mayor, horribly perplexed, refused to see her, sent his wife to her, offered her a glass of wine, which her ladyship politely declined, saying that if anything but water passed her lips that day, her husband would call her a drunk. She then made her way to the hustings. Sir Liar had meantime arrived and seated himself on the platform. Mercifully for him, his wife was under the impression that it was at the town hall that he would show himself. If she had known he was so nearby and got her eye on him, I don't doubt she would have taken him up and shaken him. The son was also on the platform. Hearing a sort of disturbance, he looked in the direction of it and saw a prodigiously large woman, dressed entirely in white, with a white parasol, talking to the people about her. He turned away without a suspicion that the white phenomenon concerned him. But again his attention was drawn to it by increased commotion, and he noticed at the same time a group of gentlemen talking very gravely among themselves and looking from the white figure to his father and from his father to the white figure. And then at last the idea struck him like a pistol shot. It is my mother. This was his own account to Mrs. Forster. He asked and was told even so. Thinking of nothing but to save his father from a collision which would have killed him, Robert Lytton ran to his father and, taking him by the arm, said, "Lady Bulwer is here." Sir Lyre needed to have this repeated 3 times before he heard, so deaf he is. And when he did hear, he fancied the Lady Bulwer meant was his sister-in-law and answered, "How very kind of Georgina to come." Robert Lytton, desperate then, seeing the white figure approaching nearer and nearer, screamed into his father's ear, "Your wife is here!" Sir Lyre staggered, turned as white as a sheet, cast one wild look at his wife, and rushed down the companion ladder, the platform steps, near the bottom of which, by the kind foresight of somebody, his carriage and servants stood ready. He jumped in, fell back almost fainting, and was galloped back to Nebworth, leaving his friends to speak for him. "Oh, darling husband, don't you think the lady had the best of the day here?" And that's where we'll leave it tonight. First, lousy words from Edward Bulwer Lytton, and then terrific words from Jane Carlyle, whoever she was. Of the two of them, who was the better writer, do you think? You decide, folks, but my money is on Jane. Bulwer Lytton has literally broken me. But I'll be back on Sunday, 9 p.m. Sydney time, with a soothing corrective, a classic of truly great writing. And I wish you all a great rest of the week. Till next time then, take care. It's slippery out there. And thanks for listening to Nitty Reads.